This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Finale by Becca Fitzpatrick. Read by Caitlin Greer. Prologue, earlier today. Scott didn't believe in ghosts. Dead men stayed in the grave, but the tunnels crisscrossing under Delphic Amusement Park, echoing with rustling, whispered sounds, made him rethink. He didn't like that his mind traveled to Harrison Gray. He didn't want to be reminded of his role in a man's murder. Moisture dripped from the low ceiling. Scott thought of blood. The fire from his torch cast skittish shadows on walls that smelled of cold, fresh earth. He thought of graves. An icy current tickled the back of his neck. Over his shoulder, he gave the darkness a long, distrustful look. Nobody knew he'd sworn an oath to Harrison Gray to protect Nora. Since he couldn't say, "Hey man, sorry for getting you killed," in person, he'd defaulted to vowing to watch over Harrison's daughter. When it came to decent apologies, it didn't make the cut, not really. But it was the best he could think of. Scott wasn't even sure an oath to a dead man held any weight. But the hollow sounds behind him made him think it did. "You coming?" Scott could just make out the dark outline of Dante's shoulders ahead. How much longer?
5 minutes, Dante chuckled. Scared?
Stiff. Scott jogged to catch up. What happens at the meeting? I've never done this before, he added, hoping he didn't sound as stupid as he felt.
Higher-ups want to meet Nora. She's their leader now.
So the Nephilim have accepted that the Black Hand is dead? Scott didn't fully believe it himself. The Black Hand was supposed to be immortal. All Nephilim were. So who'd found a way to kill him? Scott didn't like the answer he kept going back to. If Nora had done this, if Patch had helped her... It didn't matter how carefully they'd covered their tracks. They'd miss something. Everyone always did. It was only a matter of time. If Nora had murdered the Black Hand, she was in danger.
"They've seen my ring," Dante answered.
Scott had seen it too, earlier. The enchanted ring had sizzled like it had blue fire trapped under the crown. Even now it glowed a cold, dying blue. According to Dante, the Black Hand had prophesied it would be the sign of his death.
"Have they found a body?"
"No."
"And they're cool with Nora leading them?" Scott pressed. "She's nothing like the Black Hand."
"She swore a blood oath to him last night. It kicked in the moment he died. She's their leader even if they don't like it. They can replace her, but they'll test her out first and try to figure out why Hank chose her."
Scott didn't like the sound of that. "And if they replace her?" Dante flashed a dark gaze over his shoulder.
"She dies. Terms of the oath."
"We're not going to let that happen."
"No."
"So everything's cool." Scott needed confirmation that Nora was safe.
"As long as she plays along."
Scott recalled Nora's argument from earlier in the day. "I'll meet the Nephilim, and I'll make my position clear. Hank may have started this war, but I'm finishing it, and this war is ending in ceasefire. I don't care if that's not what they want to hear." He squeezed the bridge of his nose. He had a lot of work to do. He trudged forward, keeping his eyes out for puddles. They rippled like oily kaleidoscopes, and the last one he'd accidentally stepped in had soaked him up to the ankle.
"I told Patch I wouldn't let her out of my sight."
Dante grunted.
"Scared of him, too?"
"No." But he was. Dante would be, too, if he knew Patch at all.
"Why couldn't she come with us to the meeting?"
The decision to separate from Nora made him uneasy. He cursed himself for not arguing against it earlier.
"I don't know why we do half the things we do. We're soldiers. We take orders."
Scott remembered Patch's parting words to him.
"She's on your watch. Don't screw up."
The threat dug under his skin. Patch thought he was the only one who cared about Nora, but he wasn't. Nora was the closest thing to a sister Scott had. She'd stood by him when no one else would, and had talked him down off the ledge, literally. They had a bond, and not that kind of bond. He cared about Nora more than any girl he'd ever known. She was his responsibility. If it mattered, he'd vowed as much to her dead father. He and Dante pressed deeper into the tunnels, the walls tightening around their shoulders. Scott turned sideways to squeeze into the next passageway. Clumps of earth broke loose from the walls and he held his breath, half expecting the ceiling to crumble in one great heave and bury them. At last, Dante tugged on a ring pull and a door materialized out of the wall. Scott surveyed the cavernous room inside. Same dirt walls, stone floor, empty.
"Look down, trap door," Dante said.
Scott stepped off the hatch door concealed in the stonework and yanked on the handle. Heated voices carried up through the opening. Bypassing the ladder, he dropped through the hole, landing 10 feet below. He assessed the cramped, cave-like room in an instant. Nephilim men and women wearing hooded black robes formed a tight circle around two figures he couldn't see clearly. A fire roared off to the side. A branding iron plunged into the coals, glowed orange with heat.
"Answer me," a wiry old voice at the center of the circle snapped. "What is the state of your relationship with the fallen angel they call Patch? Are you prepared to lead the Nephilim? We need to know we have your full allegiance."
"I don't have to answer," Nora, the other figure, fired back. "My personal life isn't your business." Scott stepped up to the circle, improving his view.
"You don't have a personal life,"
the old white-haired woman with the wiry voice hissed, jabbing a frail finger at Nora, her sagging jowls trembling with rage.
"Your sole purpose now is to lead your people to freedom from fallen angels. You're the Black Hand's heir, and while I don't desire to go against his wishes, I will vote you out if I must."
Scott glanced uneasily at the robed Nephilim. Several nodded in agreement. "Nora," he called to her in mind speak, "what are you doing? The blood oath, you have to stay in power. Say whatever you have to, just calm them down." Nora glared around with blind hostility until her eyes found his.
"Scott?"
He nodded encouragingly. "I'm here. Don't freak them out. Keep them happy, and then I'll get you out of here." She swallowed, visibly trying to collect herself, but her cheeks still burned with outraged color. "Last night the Black Hand died. Since then, I've been named his heir, thrust into leadership, whisked away from one meeting to the next, forced to greet people I don't know, ordered to wear this suffocating robe, interrogated on a myriad of personal subjects, poked and prodded, sized up and judged, and all this without a moment to catch my breath. So excuse me if I'm still reeling." The old woman's lips pinched into a thinner line, but she didn't argue back. "I'm the Black Hand's heir. He chose me. Don't forget," Nora said, and while Scott couldn't tell if she spoke with conviction or derision, the effect was silencing.
"Answer me one thing," the old woman said shrewdly after a heavy pause. "What has become of Patch?"
Before Nora could respond, Dante stepped forward.
"She's not with Patch anymore."
Nora and Scott looked sharply at each other, then at Dante.
"What was that?"
Nora demanded of Dante in mind speak, including Scott in the three-way conversation.
"If they don't let you lead right now, you'll drop dead from the blood oath," Dante answered. "Let me handle this."
"By lying?
Got a better idea?"
"Nora wants to lead the Nephilim," Dante spoke up. "She'll do whatever it takes. Finishing her father's work means everything to her. Give her a day to grieve, and then she'll dive in fully committed. I'll train her. She can do this. Give her a chance."
"You'll train her?"
the old woman asked Dante with a piercing gaze.
"This will work. Trust me."
The elderly woman pondered a long moment.
"Brand her with the Black Hand's mark," she commanded at last.
The wild, terrified look in Nora's eyes nearly made Scott double over and vomit. The nightmares, they shot out of nowhere, dancing in his head. Faster, dizzy, then came the voice. The Black Hand's voice. Scott flattened his hands to his ears, wincing. The maniacal voice cackled and hissed until the words all ran together to sound like a kicked hive of bees. The Black Hand's mark seared into his chest throbbed, fresh pain. He couldn't differentiate between yesterday and now. His throat choked out a command. "Stop!" The room seemed to halt. Bodies shifted, and suddenly Scott felt crushed by their hostile stares. He blinked hard. He couldn't think. He had to save her. No one had been around to stop the Black Hand from branding him. Scott wouldn't let the same thing happen to Nora. The old woman walked over to Scott, her heels clicking on the floor in a slow, deliberate cadence. Deep grooves cut her skin. Watery green eyes peered out from sunken sockets. "You don't think she should show allegiance by example?" A faint, challenging smile curved her lips. Scott's heart hammered. "Make her show it through action." The words just came out. The woman tilted her head to one side. "What do you mean?" At the same time, Nora's voice slipped into his head. "Scott," she said nervously. He prayed he wasn't making things worse. He licked his lips. If the Black Hand had wanted her branded, he would have done it himself. He trusted her enough to give her this job. That's good enough for me. We can spend the rest of the day testing her, or we can get this war started already. Not 100 feet over our heads lives a city of fallen angels. Bring one down here, I'll do it myself. Brand him. If you want fallen angels to know we're serious about war, let's send them a message. He could hear his own ragged breathing. A slow smile warmed the old woman's face. "Oh, I like that very much. And who are you, dear boy?" "Scott Parnell." He edged down the collar of his t-shirt. His thumb brushed the warped skin that formed his brand, a clenched fist. "Long live the Black Hand's vision." The words tasted like bile in his mouth. Placing her spindly fingers on Scott's shoulders, the woman leaned in and kissed each of his cheeks in turn. Her skin was damp and cold as snow. "And I am Lisa Martin. I knew the Black Hand well. Long live his spirit in all of us. Bring me a fallen angel, young man, and let us send a message to our enemy." It was over soon. Scott had helped chain down the fallen angel, a skinny kid named Baruch who looked about 15 in human years. Scott's greatest fear had been that they would expect Nora to brand the fallen angel, but Lisa Martin had swept her into a private antechamber. A robed Nafil had placed the branding iron in Scott's hands. He'd gazed down at the marble slab and the fallen angel manacled to it. Ignoring Baruch's cursing vows of revenge, Scott repeated the words the robed Nafil at his side murmured in his ear, a load of crap that compared the Black Hand to a deity, and pressed the hot iron into the fallen angel's bare chest. Now Scott leaned back against the tunnel wall outside the antechamber, waiting for Nora. If she stayed in there more than 5 minutes, he was going in after her. He didn't trust Lisa Martin. He didn't trust any of the robed Nephilim. It was clear they'd formed a secret society, and Scott had learned the hard way that nothing good came of secrets. The door creaked open. Nora walked out, then threw her arms around his neck and held on tightly.
"Thank you."
He held her until she stopped trembling. "All in a day's work," he teased, trying to soothe her in the best way he knew how. "I'll put the you owe me in the mail." She sniffled a laugh. "You can tell they're really excited to have me as their new leader." "They're in shock. Shocked that the Black Hand left their future up to me. Did you see their faces? I thought they were going to start weeping. Either that or throw vegetables at me."
"So what are you going to do?"
"Hank is dead, Scott." She looked at him straight on, then dried her eyes by running her fingers under them, and he saw a flash of something in her expression he couldn't nail down. Assurance? Confidence? Or maybe outright confession. "I'm going to celebrate." Chapter 1. Tonight. I'm not a party girl. The ear-splitting music, the gyrating bodies, the inebriated smiles, not my thing. My ideal Saturday night would be at home, snuggled on the sofa and watching a rom-com with my boyfriend Patch. Predictable, low-key, normal. My name is Nora Gray, and while I used to be an average American teen, buying my clothes at the J. Crew outlet and spending my babysitting money on iTunes, Normal and I have recently become perfect strangers. As in, I wouldn't know Normal if it marched up and poked me in the eye. Normal and I parted ways when Patch strolled into my life. Patch has 7 inches on me, operates on cold, hard logic, moves like smoke, and lives alone in a super-secret, super-swanky studio beneath Delphic Amusement Park. The sound of his voice, low and sexy, can melt my heart in 3 seconds flat. He's also a fallen angel, kicked out of heaven for his flexibility when it comes to following rules. I personally believe Patch scared the pants off normal, and it took off running for the far side of the world. I might not have normalcy, but I do have stability, namely in the form of my best friend of 12 years, V. Sky. V and I have an unshakable bond that even a laundry list of differences can't break. They say opposites attract, and V and I are proof of the validity of the statement. I am slender and tallish, by human standards, with big curly hair that tests my patience. And I'm a type A personality. V is even taller, with ash blonde hair, serpentine green eyes, and more curves than a roller coaster track. Almost always, V's wishes trump mine. And unlike me, V lives for a good party. Tonight, V's wish to seek out a good time took us across town to a 4-story brick warehouse throbbing with club music, swimming with fake IDs, and jam-packed with bodies producing enough sweat to take greenhouse gases to a whole new level. The layout inside was standard, a dance floor sandwiched between a stage and a bar. Rumor had it that a secret door behind the bar led to the basement, and the basement led to a man named Storky, who operated a thriving, pirated, anything business. Community religious leaders kept threatening to board up Coldwater's hotbed of iniquity for disorderly teens, also known as the Devil's Handbag. "Groove it, baby!" V yelled at me over the mindless thump, thump, thump of music, lacing her fingers through mine and swaying our hands over our heads. We were at the center of the dance floor, being jostled and bumped on every side. "This is how Saturday night's supposed to be. You and me getting down, letting loose, working up good old-fashioned girl sweat." I did my best to give an enthusiastic nod, but the guy behind me kept stepping on the heel of my ballet flat, and at 5-second intervals I had to shove my foot back into it. The girl to my right was dancing with her elbows out, and if I wasn't careful, I knew I'd get clipped. "Maybe we should get drinks," I called to V. "Feels like Florida in here." "That's 'cause you and me are burning up the place. Check out the guy at the bar. He can't take his eyes off your smoking moves." She licked her finger and pressed it to my bare shoulder, making a sizzling noise. I followed her gaze, and my heart lurched. Dante Materazzi lifted his chin in acknowledgement. His next gesture was a little more subtle. "Wouldn't have pegged you for a dancer," he spoke to my mind. "Funny, I would have pegged you for a stalker," I shot back. Dante Materazzi and I both belong to the Nephilim race, hence the innate ability to mind speak. But the similarities stopped there. Dante didn't know how to give it a rest, and I didn't know how much longer I could dodge him. I'd met him for the first time just this morning when he'd come to my house to announce that fallen angels and Nephilim were on the brink of war, and I was in charge of leading the latter. But now I needed a break from war talk. It was overwhelming. Or maybe I was in denial. Either way, I wished he'd disappear. "Left a message on your cell phone," he said. "Gee, I must have missed it. More like I deleted it. We need to talk." "Kind of busy." To emphasize my point, I rolled my hips and swung my arms side to side, doing my best to imitate V, whose favorite television network was BET, and it showed. She had hip-hop stamped on her soul. A faint smile quirked Dante's mouth. "While you're at it, get your friend to give you some pointers. You're floundering. Meet me out back in 2. I glared at him. "Busy, remember? This can't wait." With a meaningful arch of his eyebrows, he disappeared into the crowd. "His loss," V said. "He can't handle the heat, that's all." "About those drinks," I said. "Can I bring you a Coke?" V didn't look ready to give up dancing anytime soon, and as much as I wanted to avoid Dante, I figured it was best to just get this over with. Suck it up and talk to him. The alternative was having him shadow me all night. "Coke with lime," V said. I edged my way off the dance floor, and after making sure V wasn't watching, ducked down a side hallway and out the back door. The alley was bathed in blue moonlight. A red Porsche Panamera was parked in front of me, and Dante leaned against it, arms folded loosely over his chest. Dante is 6'9" with the physique of a soldier fresh out of boot camp. Case in point, he has more muscle tone in his neck than I have in my entire body. Tonight he was wearing baggy khakis and a white linen shirt unbuttoned halfway down his chest, revealing a deep V of smooth, hairless skin. "Nice car," I said.
"It gets the job done."
"So does my Volkswagen, and it cost considerably less."
"Takes more than four wheels to be a car."
"Ugh." "So," I said, tapping my foot, "what's so urgent?"
"You still dating that fallen angel?"
It was only the third time in as many hours that he'd asked, twice by text messaging and now face to face. My relationship with Patch had gone through a lot of ups and downs, but the current trend was upward. We weren't without our issues, however. In a world where Nephilim and fallen angels would rather die than smile at each other, dating a fallen angel was a definite no-no. I stood a little taller.
"You know it." "Being careful?"
"Discreet is the watchword." Patch and I didn't need Dante to tell us it was wise not to make a lot of public appearances together. Nephilim and fallen angels never needed an excuse to teach each other a lesson, and racial tensions between the two groups were getting hotter with each passing day. It was autumn, October to be exact, and the Jewish month of Heshvan was just days away. Every year during Heshvan, fallen angels possess Nephilim bodies by the droves. Fallen angels have free rein to do as they please, and since it's the only time during the year they can actually feel physical sensation, their creativity knows no bounds. They chase after pleasure, pain, and everything in between, playing parasites to their Nephilim hosts. For Nephilim, Heshvan is a hellish prison. If Patch and I were so much as seen holding hands by the wrong individuals, we'd pay, one way or another.
"Let's talk about your image," Dante said. "We need to generate some positive media around your name. Boost Nephilim confidence in you."
I gave a theatrical snap of my fingers.
"Don't you just hate it when your approval ratings are low?"
Dante frowned.
"This isn't a joke, Nora. Heshvan starts in just over 72 hours, and that means war. Fallen angels on one side, us on the other. Everything rides on your shoulders. You're the new leader of the Nephilim army. The blood oath you swore to Hank is in effect, and I don't think I have to remind you that the consequences of breaking it are very, very real."
Queasiness pinched my stomach. I hadn't exactly applied for the job. Thanks to my deceased biological father, a truly twisted man named Hank Miller, I'd been forced to inherit the position. With the help of an otherworldly blood transfusion, he'd coerced me into transforming myself from mere human into purebred Nephil, so I could take over his army. I'd sworn an oath to lead his army, it had gone into effect upon his death, and if I failed to do that, my mom and I would die. Terms of the oath. No pressure.
"Despite every cautious measure I intend to implement, we can't completely erase your past. The Nephilim are digging around. There are rumors you're dating a fallen angel and that your loyalties are split."
"I am dating a fallen angel." Dante rolled his eyes.
"Could you say it any louder?"
I shrugged. "If that's what you really want." Then I opened my mouth, but Dante was beside me in an instant, covering it with his hand.
"I know it kills you, but could you make my job easy just this once?"
He murmured in my ear, glancing around at the shadows with obvious uneasiness, even though I was positive we were alone. I'd only been a purebred Nephil for 24 hours, but I trusted my new, sharper sixth sense. If there were eavesdroppers lurking, I'd know. "Look, I know when we first met this morning, I carelessly said the Nephilim would just have to deal with me dating a fallen angel," I said when he lowered his hand. "But I wasn't thinking. I was angry. I've spent the day giving this a lot of thought. I've talked to Patch. We're being careful, Dante. Really careful."
"Nice to know, but I still need you to do something for me."
"Like what?"
"Date a Nephil. Date Scott Parnell."
Scott was the first Nephil I'd ever befriended at the tender age of 5. I hadn't known about his true heritage back then, but in recent months he'd taken on the roles of first my tormentor, then my partner in crime, and eventually my friend. There were no secrets between us. Likewise, there was no romantic chemistry. I laughed.
"You're killing me, Dante." "It would be for show, for the sake of appearances,"
he explained.
"Just until our race warms to you. You've only been in Nephil one day. Nobody knows you. People need a reason to like you. We have to make them feel comfortable trusting you. Dating a Nephil is a good step in the right direction."
"I can't date Scott," I told Dante. "V likes him." To say V had been unlucky in love was putting it optimistically. In the past 6 months, she'd fallen for a narcissistic predator and a backstabbing slimeball. Not surprisingly, both relationships made her seriously doubt her instincts in love. Lately, she had unequivocally refused to so much as smile at the opposite sex. Until Scott came along. Early last night, just hours before my biological father had compelled me to transform myself into a purebred Nephil, V and I had come to the Devil's Handbag to watch Scott play bass for his new band, Serpentine, and she hadn't stopped talking about him since. To sweep in and steal Scott now, even if it was a ruse, would be the ultimate low blow.
It wouldn't be real,
Dante repeated, as if that made everything just peachy. Would V know that?
Not exactly. You and Scott would have to be convincing together. A leak would be disastrous, so I'd want to limit the truth to the two of us.
Meaning Scott would also be a casualty of the ruse. I did the hands-on-hips thing, going for firm and immovable. Then you're going to have to come up with someone else. I wasn't enamored with the idea of fake dating in a field to boost my popularity. In fact, it seemed like a disaster in the making, but I wanted this mess behind me. If Dante thought a Nephilim boyfriend would give me more street cred, so be it. It wouldn't be real. Obviously, Patch wouldn't be thrilled, but tackle one problem at a time, right? Dante's mouth compressed into a line and he shut his eyes briefly, summoning patience. It was an expression I'd grown quite accustomed to over the course of the day.
He'd need to be revered in the Nephilim community, Dante said thoughtfully at last. Someone Nephilim would admire and approve of.
I made an impatient gesture. Fine, just throw someone other than Scott at me.
Me.
I flinched.
Sorry, what? You?
I was too stunned to burst into laughter.
Why not?
Dante asked.
Do you really want me to start listing reasons? Because I'll keep you here all night. You've got to be at least 5 years older than me in human years. Total scandal fodder. You don't have a sense of humor and, oh yeah, we can't stand each other.
It's a natural connection. I'm your first lieutenant.
Because Hank gave you the position. I had no say in that.
Dante didn't seem to hear me, charging ahead with his make-believe version of events.
We met and felt an instant and mutual attraction. I comforted you after your father's death. It's a believable story.
He smiled.
Lots of good publicity.
If you say the P-word one more time, I'm going to
do something drastic.
Like smack him, and then smack myself for even considering this plan.
Sleep on it, Dante said. Mull it over.
Mulling it over. I counted to three on my fingers.
Okay, done. Bad idea. Really bad idea. My answer is no. You have a better idea?
Yes, but I'll need time to think it up.
Sure, no problem, Nora. He counted to three on his fingers. Okay, time's up. I needed a name first thing this morning. In case it isn't painfully obvious, your image is headed down the tubes. Word of your father's death and subsequently your new leadership position is spreading like wildfire. People are talking, and the talk isn't good. We need the Nephilim to believe in you. We need them to trust that you have their best interests in mind and that you can finish your father's work and bring us out of bondage from fallen angels. We need them to rally behind you, and we're going to give them one good reason after another, starting with a respected Nephilim boyfriend.
Hey, babe, everything okay back here? Dante and I swung around. V stood in the doorway, eyeing us with equal parts wariness and curiosity.
Hey, everything's fine,
I said a little too enthusiastically.
You never came back with our drinks, and I started to worry, V said.
Her gaze shifted from me to Dante. Recognition sparked in her eyes, and I knew she remembered him from the bar.
Who are you?
She asked him.
Him?
I cut in.
Well, he's just some random guy.
Dante stepped forward, hand extended.
Dante Materazzi. I'm a new friend of Nora's. We met earlier today when our mutual acquaintance, Scott Parnell, introduced us.
Just like that, V's face lit up.
You know Scott?
Good friend of mine, actually.
Any friend of Scott's is a friend of mine.
Inwardly, I gouged my eyes out.
So, what are you two doing back here? V asked us.
Dante just picked out a new car, I said, stepping aside to give her an unobstructed view of the Porsche. He couldn't resist showing it off. Don't look too closely, though. I think the VIN number is missing.
Poor Dante had to resort to theft since he used up all his money getting his chest waxed, and boy does it gleam.
Funny, Dante said.
I thought maybe he'd self-consciously fasten at least one more shirt button, but he didn't.
If I had a car like that, I'd show it off too, V said.
Dante said, I tried talking Nora into a ride, but she keeps blowing me off.
That's because she has a hard-A boyfriend. He must have been homeschooled because he missed all those valuable lessons we learned in kindergarten, like sharing. He finds out you took Nora for a ride, he'll wrap this shiny new Porsche around the nearest tree.
Gee, I said, look at the time. Don't you have somewhere to be, Dante?
Turns out my night's open.
He smiled, slow and easy, and I knew he was relishing every moment of intruding on my private life. I'd made it clear right off the bat this morning that any contact between us had to be done in private, and he was showing me what he thought of my rules. In a lame attempt at evening the score, I glared my meanest, coldest look at him.
You're in luck, V said. We know just the thing to fill up your night. You're gonna hang with two of the coolest girls in all of Coldwater, Mr. Dante Materazzi.
Dante doesn't dance, I quickly interjected.
I'll make an exception, just this once, he answered, opening the door for us.
V clapped her hands, jumping up and down.
I just knew this night was gonna rock,
she squealed, ducking under Dante's arm.
After you, Dante said, placing his palm on the small of my back and guiding me inside.
I batted his hand away, but to my aggravation, he leaned close and murmured,
Glad we had this little chat.
We haven't resolved anything, I spoke to his mind. This whole boyfriend-girlfriend thing, nothing is settled. Just a little something to bear in mind. And for the record, my best friend isn't supposed to know you exist.
Your best friend thinks I should give your boyfriend a run for his money, he said, sounding amused.
She thinks anything with a beating heart should replace Patch. They have unresolved issues.
Sounds promising.
He followed me down the short hall leading to the dance floor, and I felt his haughty, goading smile the whole way. The loud, monotone beat of the music drove into my skull like a hammer. I pinched the bridge of my nose, cringing against a swelling headache. I had one elbow perched on the bar, and I used my free hand to press a glass of ice water against my forehead.
Tired already?
Dante asked, leaving V on the dance floor to slide onto a bar stool beside me.
Any idea how much longer she's going to last? I asked wearily.
Looks to me like she's caught her second wind.
Next time I'm in the market for a best friend, remind me to shy away from the Energizer Bunny. She keeps going and going.
You look like you could use a ride home.
I shook my head. I drove, but I can't leave V here. Seriously, how much longer can she possibly last? Of course, I'd been asking myself the same question for the past hour.
Tell you what, go home. I'll stay with V. When she finally drops, I'll give her a ride.
I thought you weren't supposed to get mixed up in my personal life. I tried to sound surly, but I was exhausted, and the conviction just wasn't there.
Your rule, not mine.
I chewed my lip. Maybe just this once. After all, V likes you, and you actually have the stamina to keep dancing with her. I mean, this is a good thing, right? He nudged my leg.
Quit rationalizing and get out of here already.
To my surprise, I sighed with relief. Thanks, Dante. I owe you.
You can pay me back tomorrow. We need to finish our earlier conversation.
And just like that, any benevolent feelings washed away. Once again, Dante was the thorn in my foot, relentless in his pestering. If anything happens to V, I'm holding you personally responsible.
She'll be fine, and you know it.
I might not like Dante, but I did trust he'd do what he said. After all, he reported to me now. He'd sworn allegiance to me. Maybe my role as leader of all Nephilim would have a few perks after all. On that note, I left. It was a cloudless night, the moon a haunting blue against the black of night. As I walked to my car, the music from the Devil's Handbag echoed like a distant rumble. I inhaled the chilly October air. Already, my headache ebbed. The untraceable cell phone Patch had given me rang in my handbag.
How was girls' night out? Patch asked.
If V had her way, we'd be here all night. I stepped out of my shoes and slung them on my finger. All I can think about is bed.
We're sharing the same thought.
You're thinking about bed, too? But Patch had told me that he rarely slept.
I'm thinking about you in my bed.
My stomach did one of those flutter things. I'd stayed the night at Patch's place for the first time last night, and while the attraction and temptation had definitely been there, we'd managed to sleep in different rooms. I wasn't sure how far I wanted to take our relationship, but instinct told me Patch wasn't quite so indecisive. My mom's waiting up, I said. Bad timing. Speaking of bad timing, I unwillingly recalled my most recent conversation with Dante. I needed to bring Patch up to speed. Can we meet tomorrow? We need to talk.
That doesn't sound good.
I smacked a kiss into the phone. I missed you tonight.
The night's not over. After I finish up here, I could swing by your place. Leave your bedroom window unlocked.
What are you working on?
Surveillance.
I frowned. Sounds vague.
My target's on the move. I have to roll,
he said.
I'll be there as soon as I can.
And he hung up. I padded down the sidewalk, wondering who Patch was keeping an eye on and why. The whole thing sounded a little ominous. When my car, a white 1984 Volkswagen Cabriolet, came into view, I threw my shoes into the back seat and dropped behind the wheel. I stuck the key in the ignition, but the engine didn't roll over. It repeatedly made a strained chugging sound, and I took the opportunity to think a few choice and inventive words at the worthless piece of scrap metal. The car had fallen into my lap as a donation from Scott, and had given me more hours of grief than actual miles on the road. I hopped out and propped the hood, glaring speculatively at the greasy labyrinth of hoses and containers. I'd already dealt with the alternator, the carburetor, and the spark plugs. What was left?
Car trouble.
I flipped around, surprised by the sound of a nasally male voice behind me. I hadn't heard anyone approach. More perplexing, I hadn't sensed him. It would appear so, I said.
Need some help?
Pretty much, I just need a new car. He had a greasy, nervous smile.
Why don't I give you a lift? You look like a nice girl. We could have a nice talk while we drive.
I kept my distance, my mind spinning wildly as I tried to place him. Instinct told me he wasn't human, nor was he Nephilim. Funny thing was, I didn't think he was a fallen angel either. He had a round, cherubic face topped with a thatch of yellow blonde hair and floppy Dumbo ears. He looked so harmless, in fact, that it made me instantly suspicious. Instantly uneasy.
Thanks for the offer, but I'll catch a ride with my friend.
His smile vanished and he lunged for my sleeve.
Don't go.
His voice rose to a whine of desperation. I took several startled steps back.
I was trying to say...
He gulped, then hardened his eyes into glittering beads.
I need to talk to your boyfriend.
My heart beat faster and a panicky thought seized me. What if he was Nephilim and I couldn't detect it? What if he really did know about me and Patch? What if he'd found me tonight to get a message across, that Nephilim and fallen angels don't mix? I was a brand new Nephil, no match for him if it came to a physical confrontation. I don't have a boyfriend. I tried to stay calm as I turned back toward the devil's handbag.
Put me in touch with Patch!
The man called after me, that same desperate squeak pinching his voice.
He's avoiding me!
I picked up my pace.
Tell him if he doesn't come out of hiding, I'll smoke him out. I'll burn down the whole of Delphic Amusement Park if I have to.
I glanced over my shoulder warily. I didn't know what Patch had gotten himself mixed up in, but I had an uncomfortable feeling swelling in my stomach. Whoever this man was, cherubic features aside, he meant business.
He can't avoid me forever!
He scurried away on his stumpy legs until he blended into the shadows, whistling a tune that sent a jitter down my spine. Chapter 2. A half hour later, I pulled into my driveway. I live with my mom in a quintessential Maine farmhouse, complete with white paint, blue shutters, and a shroud of ever-present fog. This time of year, the trees blazed fiery shades of red and gold, and the air held the crisp smells of pine sap, burning wood, and damp leaves. I jogged up the porch steps, where five portly pumpkins watched me like sentinels, and let myself in.
I'm home,
I called to my mom, the light in the living room giving away her location. I dropped my keys on the sideboard and went back to find her. She dog-eared her page, rose from the sofa, and squeezed me in a hug.
How did your night go?
I am officially drained of every last ounce of energy, I pointed upstairs. If I make it up to bed, it will be by sheer mental power alone. While you were out, a man stopped by looking for you. I frowned. What man? He wouldn't leave his name, and he wouldn't tell me how he knew you, my mom continued. Should I be worried? What did he look like? Round face, ruddy complexion, blonde hair. Him, then. The man who had a bone to pick with Patch. I fabricated a smile. Oh, right. He's a salesman. Keeps trying to get me to commit to senior pictures with his studio. Next thing you know, he'll want to sell me graduation announcements, too. Would it be completely disgusting if I skipped washing my face tonight? Staying awake an extra 2 minutes at this point is pushing it. Mom kissed my forehead. Sweet dreams. I climbed to my bedroom, shut the door, and flopped spread-eagled on my bed. The music from the devil's handbag still pulsed at the back of my head, but I was too tired to care. My eyes were halfway shut when I remembered the window. On a groan, I staggered over and unlatched the lock. Patch could get inside, but I wished him luck trying to keep me awake long enough to elicit a response. I pulled my blankets up to my chin, felt the soft, blissful tug of a dream beckoning me closer. Let it drag me under. And then the mattress sank with the weight of another body.
Not sure why you're so enamored with this bed, Patch said. It's 12 inches too short, 4 feet too narrow, and the purple sheets aren't doing it for me. My bed, on the other hand.
I opened one eye and found him stretched out beside me, hands clasped loosely behind his neck. His dark eyes watched mine, and he smelled clean and sexy. Most of all, he felt warm pressed up against me. Despite my best intentions, the close proximity was making it increasingly difficult to concentrate on sleep.
Ha!
I said. I know you don't care how comfortable my bed is. You'd be fine on a pallet of bricks. One of the downsides of Patch being a fallen angel was that he couldn't feel physical sensation. No pain, but no pleasure either. I had to be content knowing that when I kissed him, he felt it on an emotional level only. I tried to pretend it didn't matter, but I wanted him to feel electrified by my touch. He kissed me lightly on the mouth.
What did you want to talk about?
I couldn't remember. Something about Dante. Whatever it was, it seemed unimportant. Talking in general seemed unimportant. I snuggled in closer, and Patch stroked his hand down my bare arm, making a warm, tingly sensation shoot all the way to my toes.
When do I get to see these dance moves of yours?
He asked.
We've never gone dancing at the Devil's Handbag together.
You aren't missing much. I was told tonight I'm definite fish-out-of-water material on the dance floor.
V needs to be nicer to you, he murmured, pressing a kiss to my ear.
V doesn't get credit for that line. That would go to Dante Materazzi, I confessed absent-mindedly, Patch's kisses lulling me into a happy place that didn't require a lot of reasoning or forethought.
Dante?
Patch repeated, something unpleasant creeping into his tone. Shoot. Did I forget to mention Dante was there? I asked. Patch had also met Dante for the first time this morning, and for most of the tense meeting, I feared one would drag the other into a fist fight. Needless to say, it wasn't love at first sight. Patch didn't like Dante acting like he was my political advisor and pressuring me into war with fallen angels. And Dante, well, Dante hated fallen angels on principle. Patch's eyes cooled.
What did he want?
Now I remember what I wanted to talk to you about. I cracked my knuckles. Dante's trying to sell me to the Nephilim race. I'm their leader now. Trouble is, they don't trust me. They don't know me, and Dante's made it his mission to change that.
Tell me something I don't know.
Dante thinks it might be a good idea for me to, date him. Don't worry, I rushed on. It's all for show. Gotta keep the Nephilim thinking their leader is invested. We're going to squash these rumors that I'm dating a fallen angel. Nothing says solidarity like hooking up with one of your own, you know? It makes for good press. They might even call us Nerante or Danta. Don't you like the sound of that? I asked, trying to keep the mood light. Patch's mouth turned grim.
Actually, I don't like the sound of that.
If it's any consolation, I can't stand Dante. Don't sweat this.
My girlfriend wants to date another guy. No sweat.
It's for appearances. Look on the bright side. Patch laughed, but the humor was lacking.
There's a bright side?
It's only through Heshvan. Hank got Nephilim everywhere all worked up over this one moment. He promised them salvation, and they still think they're going to get it. When Heshvan comes and ends up being like any other Heshvan on record, they'll realize it was a crapshoot. And little by little, things will go back to normal. In the meantime, while tempers are running hot and the hopes and dreams of Nephilim are hanging on the false belief that I can free them from fallen angels, we have to keep them happy.
Has it occurred to you that the Nephilim might blame you when their salvation doesn't come? Hank made a lot of promises, and when they aren't fulfilled, no one's going to point fingers at him. You're their leader now. You're the face on this campaign, Angel, he said solemnly.
I stared at the ceiling. Yes, I'd thought of it. More times today than I wanted to sanely contemplate. One forever night ago, the Archangels had made me the deal of a lifetime. They'd promised to give me the power to kill Hank, if I quashed the Nephilim Rebellion. At first, I hadn't planned on taking the deal, but Hank had forced my hand. He'd tried to burn Patch's feather and send him to hell, so I shot him. Hank was dead, and the Archangels were expecting me to stop the Nephilim from going to war. This was where things got tricky. Just hours before I shot Hank, I'd sworn an oath to him, vowing to lead his Nephilim army. Failure to comply would result in my death and my mom's. How to fulfill my promise to the Archangels and my oath to Hank? I saw only one option. I would lead Hank's army. To peace. Probably not what he had pictured while forcing me to swear the oath, but he wasn't around now to argue the details. It didn't slip my mind, however, that in turning my back on the rebellion, I was also allowing the Nephilim to remain in bondage to fallen angels. It didn't seem right, but life was paved with difficult decisions, as I was learning all too well. Right now I was more concerned with keeping the Archangels happy than the Nephilim. "What do we know about my oath?" I asked Patch. Dante said it went into effect when Hank died, but who determines if I keep it or not? Who determines what I can and can't do in terms of carrying out my oath? Take you, for instance. I'm confiding in you, a fallen angel and the sworn enemy of Nephilim. Won't the oath strike me dead for treason?
The oath you swore was about as vague as you could have made it, luckily, Patch said with obvious relief.
Oh, it had been vague, all right, and to the point. If you die, Hank, I'll lead your army. Not a word more.
As long as you stay in power and lead the Nephilim, I think you're within the terms of the oath, Patch said. You never promised Hank you'd go to war.
In other words, the plan is to stay out of war and keep the Archangels happy. Patch sighed almost to himself.
Some things never change.
After Heshvan, after the Nephilim give up on freedom, and after we've put a big, fat smile of contentment on the Archangels' faces, we can put this behind us. I kissed him. It'll just be you and me.
Patch groaned. It can't come fast enough.
Hey, listen, I told him, anxious to move on to any topic other than war. I was approached by a man tonight, a man who wants a word with you.
Patch gave a nod. Pepper Freiberg.
Does Pepper have a face as round as a basketball? Another nod.
He's tailing me because he thinks I went back on an agreement we had. He doesn't want a word with me. He wants to chain me in hell and dust his hands of me.
Is it just me, or does that sound kind of serious?
Pepper Freiberg is an archangel, but he's got his hand in more than one pot. He's leading a double life, spending half his time as an archangel and the other half moonlighting as a human. Up until now, he's been living the best of both worlds. He has the power of an archangel, which he doesn't always use for good, while indulging in human vices.
So Pepper was an archangel. No wonder I hadn't been able to identify him. I hadn't had a lot of experience dealing with archangels. Patch went on.
Someone has figured out his crooked game, and word has it they're blackmailing him. If Pepper doesn't pay up soon, his vacation time on Earth is going to become a lot more permanent. The archangels will strip his power and tear out his wings if they find out what he's been up to. He'll be stuck down here for good.
The pieces clicked together. He thinks you're blackmailing him.
A while back, I figured out what he was up to. I agreed to keep his secret, and in return he agreed to help me get my hands on a copy of the Book of Enoch. He hasn't delivered on his promise, and it seems logical that he thinks I'm feeling hung out to dry. But I think he must have been careless, and there's another fallen angel out there looking to benefit off his misdeeds.
Did you tell Pepper that?
Patch smiled.
Working on it. He's not feeling very talkative.
He said he'll burn down all of Delphic if that's what it takes to smoke you out. I knew Archangels didn't dare set foot inside Delphic Amusement Park, fearing for their safety in a place built by and highly populated with fallen angels. So the threat made sense.
His neck's on the line and he's getting desperate. I might have to go under.
Go under?
Lie low. Keep my head down.
I pushed myself up on one elbow and stared at Patch. How do I fit into this picture?
He thinks you're his one-way ticket to me. He's going to be sticking to you like spandex. He's parked down the street as we speak, eyes peeled for my car.
Patch stroked his thumb across my cheek.
He's good, but not good enough to keep me from having quality time with my girl.
Promise me you're always going to be two steps ahead. The thought of Pepper catching Patch and putting him on the fast track to hell didn't exactly give me a warm, fuzzy feeling. Patch hooked a finger in my neckline and pulled me into a kiss.
Don't worry, Angel. I've been doing this sneaky stuff longer.
When I woke, the bed next to me was cold. I smiled at the memory of falling asleep curled in Patch's arms, concentrating on that rather than the probability that Pepper Freiburg, a.k.a. Mr. Archangel with a Dirty Secret, had sat outside my house all night playing spy. I thought back to a year ago, to the fall of my sophomore year. Back then, I hadn't so much as kissed a guy. Never could I have imagined what lay in store. Patch meant more to me than I could put into words. His love and faith in me took the sting out of the hard decisions I'd been forced to make recently. Whenever doubt and regret crept into my conscience, all I had to do was think of Patch. I wasn't sure I'd made the right choice every time, but I knew one thing for certain. I'd made the right choice in Patch. I couldn't give him up. Ever. At noon, V called.
How about me and you go running? She said. I just got a new pair of tennis shoes, and I need to break these bad boys in.
V, I have blisters from dancing last night. And hold on, since when do you like running?
It's no secret I'm carrying around a few extra pounds, she said. I'm big-boned, but that's no excuse for letting a little flab hold me back. There's a guy out there named Scott Parnell, and if shedding some extra weight is what it's going to take for me to get up the courage to go after him, then that's what I'm going to do. I want Scott to look at me the way Patch looks at you. I wasn't serious about this diet and exercise stuff before, but I'm turning over a new leaf. Starting today, I love exercise. It's my new BFF.
Oh, and what about me?
Soon as I lose this weight, you'll be my number one girl again. I'll pick you up in 20. Don't forget a sweatband. Your hair does scary stuff when it gets damp.
I hung up, stretched a tank over my head, followed it up with a sweatshirt, and laced myself into tennis shoes. Right on time, V picked me up, and right away it became apparent we weren't driving to the high school track. She steered her purple neon across town in the opposite direction from school, humming to herself. I said, "Where are we going?"
"I was thinking we should run hills. Hills are good for the glutes."
She turned the neon onto Deacon Road, and a light popped on in my head. "Hang on, Scott lives on Deacon Road."
Come to think of it, he does.
We're running by Scott's house? Isn't that kind of, I don't know, stalkerish?
That's a real sad hat way of looking at it, Nora. Why not think of it as motivation? Eye on the prize.
What if he sees us?
You're friends with Scott. If he sees us, he'll probably come out and talk to us, and it would be rude not to stop and give him a couple of minutes of our time.
In other words, this isn't about running. This is a pickup.
V wagged her head. You're no fun at all.
She cruised up Deacon, a winding stretch of scenic road bordered on both sides by dense evergreens. In another couple of weeks, they'd be frosted with snow. Scott lived with his mom, Lynn Parnell, in an apartment complex that came into view around the next bend. Over the summer, Scott had moved out and gone into hiding. He'd deserted Hank Miller's Nephilim army, and Hank had searched tirelessly for him, hoping to make an example of him. After I killed Hank, Scott had been free to move home. A cement fence caged the property, and while I was certain privacy had been the intent, it gave the place the feel of a compound. V pulled into the entrance, and I had a flashback to the time she had helped me snoop in Scott's bedroom, back when I thought he was an up-to-no-good jerk. Boy, had things changed. V parked near the tennis courts.
The nets were long gone, and someone had decorated the turf with graffiti. We got out and stretched for a couple of minutes. V said, "I don't feel safe leaving the neon unattended for long in this neighborhood. Maybe we should do laps around the complex. That way I can keep an eye on my baby." "Uh-huh. It also gives Scott more opportunities to see us." V had on pink sweatpants with Diva stamped across the butt in gold glitter, and a pink fleece jacket. She also had on full makeup, diamond studs in her ears, and a ruby cocktail ring, and she smelled like Pure Poison by Dior. Just your average day out running. We picked up our feet and started a slow jog along the dirt trail circling the complex. The sun was out, and after three laps, I stripped off my sweatshirt, tying it around my waist. V beelined to a weathered park bench and plunked down, sucking air. "That had to be about 5 miles, she said. I surveyed the trail. "Sure, give or take 4 miles. "Maybe we should peek in Scott's windows," V suggested. "It's Sunday. He might be oversleeping and need a friendly wake-up call." "Scott lives on the third floor. Unless you have a 40-foot ladder stashed in the trunk of the neon, window peeping is probably out." "We could try something more direct, like knocking on his door." Just then, an orange Plymouth Barracuda, circa 1970, vroomed into the parking lot. It pulled under the carport and Scott swung out. Like most Nephilim men, Scott has the body of someone seemingly well acquainted with a weight room. He's also unusually tall, pushing 6'6". He keeps his hair cropped as short as a prison inmate's, and he's good-looking, in a tough, hardened way. Today, he was wearing mesh basketball shorts and a t-shirt with the sleeves ripped off. V fanned herself. "Yowza." I stuck my hand in the air, intending to call out to Scott and flag his attention, when the Barracuda's passenger door opened and Dante emerged. "Check it out," V said. "It's Dante. Do the math. 2 of them and 2 of us. I knew I'd like running." "I'm feeling the sudden urge to keep running," I muttered, "and not stop until I'd put a lot of ground between me and Dante." I wasn't in the mood to follow up last night's conversation. Likewise, I wasn't in the mood for V to play matchmaker. She was too aggravatingly good at it. "Too late. We've been made." V whipped her arm over her head like a helicopter propeller. Sure enough, Scott and Dante leaned back against the Barracuda, shaking their heads and grinning at us. "You stalking me, Gray?" Scott hollered. "He's all yours," I told V. "I'm going to finish running."
"What about Dante? He'll feel like the third wheel," she said.
"It'll be good for him, trust me."
"Where's the fire, Gray?"
Scott called out, and to my dismay, he and Dante started jogging over.
"I'm training," I shot back. "I'm thinking about trying out for track."
"Track doesn't start until spring," V reminded me.
"Hang it all." "Uh-oh, heart rate's dropping," I yelled at Scott.
And on that note, I took off running in the opposite direction. I heard Scott on the trail behind me. A minute later, he snagged the strap of my tank top, tugging on it playfully.
"Wanna tell me what's going on?"
I turned to face him. "What does it look like?"
"It looks like you and V came over to see me under the pretense of running."
I gave his shoulder a congratulatory pat.
"Good work, Ace." "So why are you running away? And why does V smell like a perfume factory?"
I stayed quiet, letting him figure it out.
"Ah,"
he said at last. I spread my hands. "My work here is done."
"Don't take this the wrong way, but I'm not sure I'm ready to hang out with V all day. She's pretty intense."
Before I could give him the sage advice, "Fake it till you make it," Dante pulled up beside me.
"A word with you?"
he asked.
"Oh boy," I said under my breath.
"That's my cue to go," Scott said,
and to my discouragement, he trotted away, leaving me alone with Dante.
"Can you run and talk at the same time?" I asked Dante, thinking I'd prefer not to have to look him in the eye while he rehashed his thoughts on our jury-rigged relationship.
Plus, it spoke volumes about just how into this conversation I was. By way of answer, Dante picked up his pace, jogging beside me.
"Glad to see you out running," he said.
"And why is that?" I panted, shoving some loose hairs off my sweat-soaked face. "You get a thrill out of seeing me a complete mess?"
"That, and it's good training for what I have in store for you."
"You have something in store for me? Why do I get the feeling I don't want to hear more?"
You may be Nephilim now, Nora, but you're at a disadvantage. Unlike naturally conceived Nephilim, you don't have the advantage of extreme height, and you aren't as physically powerful.
I'm a lot stronger than you think, I argued.
Stronger than you were, but not as strong as a female Nephil. You have the same body you did when you were human, and while it was adequate back then, it's not enough to compete now. Your frame is too slender. Compared to me, you're abysmally short, and your muscle tone is pathetic.
Now that's flattery.
I could tell you what I think you want to hear instead of what you need to hear, but would I really be your friend then?
Why do you think you need to tell me any of this?
You're not prepared to fight. You don't stand a chance against a fallen angel. It's as simple as that.
I'm confused. Why do I need to fight? I thought I made it clear repeatedly yesterday that there isn't going to be a war. I'm leading the Nephilim to peace. And keeping the archangels off my back. Patch and I had decided unequivocally that enraged Nephilim made a better enemy than the all-powerful archangels. It was evident that Dante wanted to go into battle, but we disagreed, and as leader of the Nephilim army, the decision was ultimately mine. I felt like Dante was undermining me, and I didn't like it one bit. He stopped, catching me by the wrist so he could look straight at me.
"You can't control everything that happens from here on out," he said quietly, and a chill of foreboding slipped through me like I'd swallowed an ice cube. "I know you think I've got it out for you, but I promised Hank I'd look after you. I'll tell you one thing. If war breaks out, or even a riot, you won't make it. Not in your current state. If something happens to you and you're unable to lead the army, you'll have broken your oath, and you know what that means." Oh, I knew what it meant all right. Jumping into my own grave and dragging my mom in behind me. "I want to teach you enough skills to get by, as a precaution," Dante said. "That's all I'm suggesting."
I swallowed. "You think if I train with you, I can get to the point where I'll be strong enough to handle myself?"
"Against fallen angels, sure.
But what about the archangels?" I'd promised to halt the rebellion. Training for battle wasn't aligned with that goal.
"I think it's worth a shot."
The idea of war turned my stomach into a bundle of knots, but I didn't want to show fear in front of Dante. He already thought I couldn't handle myself. "So which is it? Are you my pseudo-boyfriend or my personal trainer?" His mouth twitched.
"Both."
Chapter 3 When V dropped me off after running, there were two missed calls on my cell phone. The first was from Marcy Miller, my sometimes arch-nemesis, and, as fate would have it, my half-sister by blood, but not by love. I'd spent the past 17 years having no knowledge that the girl who stole my chocolate milk in elementary school and adhered feminine pads to my school locker in junior high shared my DNA. Marcy had figured out the truth first and flung it in my face. We had an unspoken contract not to discuss our relationship publicly, and for the most part, the knowledge hadn't changed us any. Marcy was still a spoiled anorexic airhead, and I still spent a good portion of my waking hours watching my back, wondering what humiliation scheme she'd launch at me next. Marcy hadn't left a message, and I couldn't guess what she'd want from me, so I moved to the next missed call. Unknown number. The voicemail consisted of controlled breathing, low and masculine, but no actual words. Maybe Dante, maybe Patch, maybe Pepper Freiberg. My personal number was listed, and with a little investigative spirit, Pepper could have tracked it down. Not the most reassuring of thoughts. I hauled out my piggy bank from under my bed, removed the rubber cheat plug, and shook out $75. Dante was picking me up at 5 tomorrow morning for wind sprints and weightlifting, and after one disgusted glance at my current tennis shoes, he'd remarked, "Those won't make it through a day of training." So here I was, using my allowance to buy cross trainers. I didn't think the threat of war was as serious as Dante had made it sound, especially since Patch and I secretly had plans to pull the Nephilim out of the doomed uprising. But his words on my size, speed, and agility had struck a chord. I was smaller than every other Nephil I knew. Unlike them, I had been born into a human body. Average weight, average muscle tone, average in every single aspect. And it had taken a blood transfusion and the swearing of a changeover vow to turn me into a Nephil. I was one of them in theory, but not in practice. I didn't want the discrepancy to paint a target on my back, but a little voice at the back of my mind whispered it might. And I had to do whatever it took to stay in power. "Why do we have to start so early?" should have been my first question to Dante. But
but I suspected I knew the answer. The world's fastest humans would appear as though out for a leisurely stroll if racing beside Nephilim. At top speed, I suspected that Nephilim in their prime could run upward of 50 miles per hour. If Dante and I were seen using that speed on the high school track, it would draw a lot of unwanted attention. But in the pre-dawn